It's not February 14th. It's February 15th. But I was focused on the 14th because that's Valentine's Day, and if you're married, you don't want to mess that up. So if you're single and with the city, you don't. So I think that's why I have the 14th. I'll try to. So today's the 15th, not the 14th. So welcome to February 15th, day after Valentine's Day, and who knows, I think I got the lectures notes page right. Page 81, lecture 9, and I am recording. Thank you. I think we dropped a student since I posted that. Face coverings, face coverings, face coverings, face coverings, face coverings. As far as I can see, I can't see that far away. Are you guys got face coverings on? Stand back from the monitor if you don't, web students. All right, so this is stuff we've seen before. We have a couple upcoming opportunities for sales and marketing fair, in person and virtual, the 22nd and 24th. A series of other exploration fairs coming up. One is on the 16th, two on the 16th, one on the 17th. If you're interested, check the slides or let me know. We know that Extra Credit number 2 is up and running, closes Thursday. We know that Mini Test 4 closes tonight. Have taken it. Mini Test 4, haven't taken it. Don't know what I'm talking about. All right, so remember to do it. Nothing new there. Nothing new there. So this I thought was interesting, even though I knew that as I posted it, it was after, I knew it was after Valentine's Day, but we're still having supply chain issues. Supply and demand still affects business, affects prices. So I thought it was okay to continue talking about this sad situation of our economy. Candy makers say to expect shortages for Valentine's Day. Hershey's company said it's running low on Valentine's Day candy this year, thanks to a shortage of labor and factory capacity, so factors affecting business and marketing. Many grocery shelves are already bare, where heart-shaped chocolates should sit, and Hershey said it would likely stay that way leading up to the holiday. So impacts on our channels of distribution, product place, price promotion, this is an issue of place. There's a very big effort now between now and Valentine's to get absolutely everything we have in the hands of retailers. Hershey said it has added production lines recently, hired more workers, but it hasn't been enough to keep up with America's appetite for Reese's chocolate, Jolly Ranchers candy, and other treats. How many candy eaters do we have? Chocolate or candy eaters? Well, quite a few. Webbies, some of you like it too. So Mr. Boscal said Hershey's has sent salespeople to stores to help restock the shelves, and the inventory issues vary by retailer, so supply and demand issues, channel partners, we're trying to work with our channel partners to help them get our stock on their shelves for them and us. Consumers have also been buying more sweets, supermarket industry executives said, increasing pressure on candy supplies, supply and demand. Big brands are leaving sales on the table and risk losing market share long-term if they can't keep up with demand, say the analysts. Hershey says it expects to maintain its market share this year since everyone in the sector is running out of inventory. So market competition, are we going to lose consumers' interest because, hey, we aren't on the shelf, you're on the shelf, they switch over to you, we've lost your business? Hershey and Mondelez have cut back on advertising in recent months. So here comes an interesting question. Do you or don't you continue to advertise in times of troubled supply chain? In times of recession, which isn't what we're in. Advertise or not advertise. In recession, when things are down, the notion is, the advice is continue advertising to keep yourself in the minds of consumers. Here, consumers want you. It's not that they aren't aware of you or don't want you, but what's the point of advertising to increase demand even more when you can't supply it? How many guys watch the Super Bowl? Guys or gals, whatever. And how many watch commercials? And how many noticed a boatload of commercials for electric vehicles? How many of you know that electric vehicles are actually pretty hard to get right now because of the supply chain issues and chip shortage, yeah? Why bother, isn't the same question, why bother with a bunch of advertisements for products you can't get right now? Here the issue is a little different. To build consumer awareness, are the full public aware of electric vehicles? Who's offering them? What platforms there are? So even though we don't have the supply yet, we do want to build awareness leading to interest, leading demand into the future. So it plays out differently depending on what we're talking about in terms of whether or not you spend ad dollars at a particular moment in time. Here, we can't supply you with any more product. There's no real point in advertising Valentine's Day candies. The candy makers, along with other U.S. food makers, are also raising prices to offset some of the higher costs they face for raw ingredients, trucking, labor, and packaging. That higher price hasn't entered demand yet. This goes to the issue of, at least at this particular point in time for this industry, price elasticity of demand. What happens to, how many of you guys remember that term from Micro? What happens to your demand as you increase prices? Does it go down a little bit, a lot, stay steady, and in some rare cases even go up? But here we have an interesting case. We have inelastic demand in the candy industry. People really want it even though prices are going up. I need to get me what Jeffrey Gannett, the president of Macy's, said. I'm going to need to get me a reverse mentor to help me better understand NFTs, the metaverse, and virtual properties, because I'm not quite getting what I'm going to tell you about. I do get Victoria's Secret, that I understand, but the rest of it I don't. Victoria's Secret files trademark to enter the metaverse. We know about the metaverse. We've heard of the metaverse. We know about the metaverse. We don't know what we're talking about. Metaverse. Victoria's Secret is the latest clothing brand with metaverse aspirations. The lingerie retailer recently filed a trademark application with U.S. Patent and Trade Office to offer virtual goods. Virtual goods, not the real thing, things in the metaverse. So this is the metaverse in marketing and the legal issues in marketing. Let's understand trademark applications. The application lists downloadable virtual goods for the creation and trade of digital collectibles using blockchain, which is the technology also used to create non-fungible tokens and other crypto-based assets. In addition, Victoria's Secret is looking to trademark retail store services featuring virtual goods, such as clothing, undergarments, footwear, and fashion accessories for use in virtual environments and virtual fashion shows. Part of our channels of distribution. What are you going to do? You're going to have an avatar wearing sexy shorts? What? I don't know. Somebody's going to help me. I'm going to have to get the digital guy in marketing to help me. All right, so that's a part of this. This is from another source, but it continues. Victoria's Secret is among the major brands, such as Nike and Adidas, to be filing patents to protect their brands in the metaverse. Many of these may never get used, but experts say that brands are wise to act early rather than sitting on the sidelines and missing opportunities. So strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, and threats at the strategic level. Should I go out and get that site called Mark's Manufacturing in the Metaverse, even though I'm not sure what I'm going to do with it right now, rather than let somebody else pick it up later? Smart brands will indeed buy virtual real estate, hire builders to develop their brand presence and experiences, where they will sell both digital and physical products to consumers who split their time between the real world and the metaverse, the virtual world. Laggard brands and organizations will be stuck in the real world, and even worse, in the ghetto that the legacy internet will become. So apparently the internet that we're used to is going to be the ghetto of the internet, and the metaverse will be the real new future. This guy is not an unbiased source. He's the founder of the industry website Retail Profit, so he has a vested interest in this. But yikes, is this the future of retailing? What, are you an early adopter of all this as a brand, as a marketer? Are you going to be a laggard and hang back? And what will it mean to your business? I don't know yet. Come back in 5 years. We'll check in. Okay, so there we go. As you know, I couldn't very well let the Super Bowl go quite yet. So I just spent $7 million plus production, of course. Okay, so, you know, $7 million, $30 million, who's counting? On my ad, how did I do? Well, the number one ad on the USA Today ad meter, which is a ranking from viewers, right? It's not experts doing the ranking, was this one.
Barbie really wants this dream house. It's got stunning views and a slide.
Barbie's ready for fun.
So cool.
And Barbie found out about this dream house with an alert from Rocket Homes.
She did?
Well, it's a super competitive market. Everyone wants to buy the dream house.
Better offer Betty.
I'll go 10 over asking.
Cash offer Carl.
Straight cash.
House flipper skipper.
Let's tear it to the studs.
You vultures, you're gonna start a bidding war.
This is less than ideal. Oh no.
Don't worry, Barbie has a verified approval that shows her finances are backed by Rocket Mortgage. So Barbie wins.
But we need a house.
Oh, I found a fixer-upper castle on Rocket Homes.
It has good bones, but really bad neighbors.
I like his vibe. Get your dream house all in one place with Rocket Homes and Rocket Mortgage. For a better way to find and finance, Rocket can.
So cute, funny. I didn't find it my number one. Who really liked it as their number one ad? None of you guys voted on USA Today's Reader Poll. I did like this one, although it doesn't make me want to buy the product. I like the ad.
Alexa, it's game day.
Streaming football on Prime Video. Closing blinds. Chilling rosé.
Wow. It's like she can read your mind.
I'm thinking, I shouldn't get a spray tan, you know? Because that's on Wednesday.
Activating blender.
Funeral's on Monday.
But what about the gold, Papa?
Can't you see the treasure all along? It was here.
Love the eye patch. When is the show open?
March 8th.
Setting reminder to fake your own death on March 8th.
What the?
When you have to do those love scenes with hot guys, is that fun or is that like the worst?
It's the worst.
Tell me lies, tell me sweet little lies.
This seafood is amazing.
Announcement. You can thank Colin. He left the oysters in the car for 5 hours.
It's probably better Alexa can't read your mind.
So I certainly liked it. I don't know if it makes me want to rush out and get Alexa. So we have Rockamo's, Amazon, Doritos, Cheetos, which we saw, Kia, the RoboDog, and Toyota, the brothers, as the top five. How about the bottom five? Says these people spent who knows how much money to be in the bottom ranking by viewers. And I'm making that point for a second. So DraftKings Fortune, Life's a Gamble, Wallbox, Can Supercharge Seth Embrace Electricity Again, Bud Light Next Zero in the Way of Possibility, eToro Flying Your Way, and Coinbase. Coinbase was, of course, if you watch the show, the bouncing QR code that bounced around the screen the way old PCs used to do. How many people saw that ad? Okay, that was the number one worst rated ad by USA Today viewers. Now, as it happened, my wife said this year we can't hold a Super Bowl party for, well, I guess obvious reasons. Then she went out of town to visit with my daughter and left me alone with myself and I. So me, myself, and I were watching this, and we went up to get ourselves a little snack. So we're in the other room, and our phone's in the TV room plugged in, and I hear this thing going on and on and on, and I finally look up to see what is it? And it's this QR code. So finally, I get impatient. I go to get my phone. Just about the time I got to my phone to put it on the screen, it was over. Did anybody click on it? Did anybody cue? Oh, holy mackerel. So my point is, while it was rated the worst by viewers, the experts rated it the best. So my comment is, what's best in marketing is a matter of perspective and perception, right? So Coinbase's QR code. Cinematic, no. Soul storing, not a bit. But cryptocurrency exchange Coinbase's Super Bowl spot was a marketing moment unlike any other in this year's big game. Inspired by Minos DVD screensavers, the spot from Accenture Interactive featured little more than a color-changing QR code drifting at an angle across the screen. Scanning it, of course, took you to a Coinbase landing page with a promotional credit. Did you click to be invested in like $3 million worth of coins? Who did that? Just. Oh, you couldn't. Oh, you couldn't do it. See, the server crashed. Right. Had it just been 15 seconds, casual viewers might have shrugged off the odd spot and gone back to their snacks. Sorry, that's what I was doing. But running a leisurely 60 seconds, the spot and its hypnotic music became increasingly curious, inducing until finally many of us just had to pull out our phones and scan it. In a night defined by crypto players working hard to get your attention, Coinbase leaped past simple brand awareness and directly engaged viewers by the million. It got my attention.
That was the best part about it.
Literally, me and my friends were like screaming with rejoice as soon as it hit the one corner.
And had you gotten there, it would have, well, there we go, it crashed. Well, that was more popular than we thought. We need a quick timeout. We'll email you soon as things get back to normal. And that's as much as I got for you. So, so that one, lowest rated by viewers, highest rated by the experts in terms of something interesting that got attention. All right, so we pick up with lecture notes, page 81 and page 136 in the textbook, continuing chapter 5, Understanding Consumer Behavior. Bear with me just a second. So we are trying to understand consumers' behavior from a marketing viewpoint. And as you've begun to gather, since this is the third lecture we're talking about understanding consumer behavior, it's hard to do that. It's hard to understand what influences consumers to pay attention to your brand, understand your brand, buy your brand, be happy with your brand, come back to get your brand again. And so we continue this march. In this case, we're continuing with the psychological influences on consumer decision making, including learning. Learning involves changes in behavior resulting from observation and experience. And for us, that's a good thing in marketing. Otherwise, you buy a brand once, never learn anything, and never learn anything new. You just buy the same brand over and over again. Fortunately, that isn't what happens. So how do consumers learn? Well, one approach is through something called classical conditioning. Anybody remember classical conditioning from psychology? Who comes to mind when you think classical conditioning? Pavlov and his dogs. Okay, so what's the basic idea of classical conditioning? Pavlov discovers in experiments with dogs, first of all, if you ring a bell for a dog that hasn't had any learning, what does the dog do with the ring of the bell? Nothing. Ignores it. Okay, it has no meaning to the dog. So what Pavlov does is he rings the bell and gives the dog a spray of meat powder, meat food. And he does that over and over again. Well, of course, in order to eat the food, the dog salivates, right? The glands get going. That's not voluntary. The dog doesn't think, in order to eat food, I've got to get my glands going. Go glands, right? It's an automatic response. And one time, he rings the bell and doesn't give the dog any food. And guess what the dog still does? Still salivates. Holy mackerel. What he has done is taken a stimuli with no meaning, and he has conditioned it to give a conditioned response. So the unconditioned stimulus, dog food, creates an unconditioned response, salivation. We pair it with what becomes the conditioned response, or the conditioned stimuli, the thing that has no meaning, and pretty soon it develops a conditioned response, which is the same salivation. Well, what's this have? Does it work on people? All right, so you're walking down the street one day, and all of a sudden a dog rushes out from a side behind a bush, barks at you, woof, and bites you, inflicting grievous pain upon your calf. You don't like that. You get your rabies shots, you get repairs, you get the infection taken care of. Next time you're walking down the street and you hear a dog bark, woof, what do? You pause and say, last time I heard that, a dog rushed out and bit me. I had to think about what to do next, or do you jump out of there? You too can learn through classical conditioning. You too can respond to this thing that, prior to that, dog barks didn't bother you. Now they do. You've learned. Dog barks may result in harm. What's this have to do with marketing if it works in human behavior? Marketers take things which have no meaning to you, brand names, images, and they pair it repetitively with something, and pretty soon you learn to respond to that brand name, even though it had no meaning to you before, with the response that they were generating. Victoria's Secret, although they've moved beyond their sexist view of the world for a long time, paired sexiness and angels and their name. And pretty soon, when you saw an angel, you were thinking sexy Victoria's Secret. They've moved beyond that to other ways of thinking. But that's a pairing of something without meaning. The classic bad example from the old days was the Marlboro cowboy. When you saw a cowboy, you naturally thought machismo and manliness. Pair that with Marlboro, pair that with Marlboro, pair that with Marlboro. Pretty soon, as soon as you saw Marlboro, you felt manliness for you. So, We do learn through classical conditioning. Pavlov and his dogs is the example. Bell rings, I get a treat. Bell rings, I get a treat. It went on that way for days. Then out of the blue, bell rings, and I get nothing at all, nada. I mean, can you seriously call my attack unprovoked? The dark truth about Pavlov's dogs. Little classical conditioning humor. Another way that we learn is through operant conditioning. Do you remember that from your psych course? Anybody know what animals or researcher comes to mind with that? Yes! Who said Skinner? Gold coin, a Bitcoin, not a Bitcoin, Bitcoin your way. All right, Skinner and his rats. So what does Skinner do? Skinner gets a hungry rat, puts him in a maze. And the hungry rats are curious anyhow, but this hungry rat is scaring around the maze trying to figure out what's going on. And eventually, as he works on his environment, operating on his environment in a trial and error fashion, operant conditioning, operating on your environment in a trial and error fashion, eventually the rat pokes at a bar. Not that kind of bar, this kind of bar. Pokes at a bar, and out pops a food pellet. Whoa, the rat is satisfied. What happens the second time you put the rat in the maze? Goes around a little bit. When it sees a bar, boom, goes right for the bar, right? Because it's learned through this operant conditioning that the bar gives it food. Man, the third time you put it in the maze, zip, 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 boom, it's there. There's no wandering around. It has learned through this trial and error operation in its environment, if it gets reward, it's going to go for it again. If he got a shock, he wouldn't do it again. You need the reward. Unlike classical conditioning, which is automatic, operant conditions requires a bit of cognition. You have to think about it. I got a reward. I want that reward again. What's this have to do with human behavior? So, before the Super Bowl, you were wandering through the grocery store. And you're throwing stuff. You got some Doritos, and you got some Fritos, and you got some soda. And you see a display for a sweet. And there's no candy, because we have a candy shortage. Kumquat-flavored ding-dongs.
What?
Kumquat-flavored ding-dongs. So you throw some kumquat-flavored ding-dongs in your cart, and you take them home. The group loves these things. They can't, where did you get those? What are those? Holy mackerel! What have you learned? People seem to like kumquat-flavored ding-dongs. So what do you do next time you go to the store? I'm betting you dollars to donuts. You look for some more kumquat-flavored ding-dongs. You take them back another time. People still are crazy for them. Third time, man, you're looking for kumquat-flavored ding-dongs. What have you learned? By operating in sort of a random fashion in your environment, you've learned that something provides a reward and learned to go back to it again, just like our rat in a maze. We'll press lever for food. Works for rats. We'll try operating in my environment in a trial and error fashion, get a reward, and we'll do it again. Kumquat flavored ding-dongs at your service. Social learning is another way that we learn, and it occurs, gives us changed behavior. The idea of social learning is we learn from observing other folks in our environment. One research said that from a very young infant age, baby girls start to imitate women, and baby boys start to imitate men. They begin to learn this social behavior from a very early age. And of course, it continues. What does it mean to be? Well, whatever you are, what does it mean to have a particular background? What does it mean to be middle class? What does it mean to be upper income? What does it mean to be anything you like? So, here we see social learning in a cartoon. Stop it, PJ. Stop copying me, says Jeffy. Of course, what is Jeffy doing up on the couch there? He's reading a book, just like Dad is reading a book. He's learned to do that. And what are we seeing that PJ is doing? Copying him. He's learning how to behave. This is an ancient, but I like it, classic example of social learning as a public service announcement. And do you really want this sort of social learning to occur?
Like father, like son.
Thank you.
Like father, like son. Think about it. For information on smoking and heart disease, ask your heart association.
So we see the little kid learning what his dad's doing. He's squirting the squirt gun in the hose, and he's throwing a rock, and he's throwing a rock, and now he's sitting down next to the tree and reaching for a cigarette. Is that really what you want to teach your kid? Social learning occurs. And so we find, for example, we'll say this again later on in another part of a lecture, but how many of you use the same brand of fill-in-the-blank laundry detergent as your parents do? Did you really go out and search for that, or did you just learn that that's what mom uses? You're going to use it too. Good enough for her, good enough for you, sort of logic, right? Social learning there. Cognitive learning. This is, of course, logical, rational thinking. Thinking about the pros and cons, the advantages and the disadvantages, the attributes of one brand versus the attributes of another brand, and learning which one is best for you. So that's another form of learning that clearly applies to humans and consumers, right? Classical conditioning, operant conditioning, social learning, cognitive learning, all of these involve changes from behavior resulting, changes in behavior resulting from observation experience. They lead to, in the right situation, something very dear and near to our hearts, brand loyalty. Consumers can learn to prefer one brand over all others, sort of important to us in marketing. How you learn it, whether you learn it because we've created a really machismo association for you, you see a cowboy, you want Marlboro cigarettes. You learn it through trial and error. You've thought about it. This is the rational choice for you. If it is satisfying your needs, wants, and desires, you can learn to be brand loyal to it. So, the processes we're going through create attitudes and beliefs about the brands out there, the brand you're considering, the brand you're going to buy. So based on what you've learned from processing information, evaluating alternatives, making a choice, evaluating the choices, consumers form beliefs about the stores they shopped in. Would you shop in that store again? Would you go to that website again? Would you buy from that e-tailer again? Or was that a bad idea? About the products that they buy, the brands that they buy, about the decision process they used. Should you have bought the cheapest one? Was it worth buying the most expensive one? Should you trust the reviewers on this site, etc.? And they form attitudes, either favorable or unfavorable, about all of these things. Was this a good thing or a bad thing? Did I like it or didn't I like it? Should I do it again or shouldn't I do it again? So you'd want to know all of this for your consumers, for your customers, right? When attitudes are positive, they influence the consumer's next choice. To ask the obvious question with the obvious answer, if things went well and they like what they did, what are they going to do next time, arguably? Do it again. Go get another one of those kumquat-flavored ding-dongs, right? And if attitudes don't exist, I never heard of this thing, this brand. They aren't aware of it. Or they're negative. Well, those also influence the consumer's behavior. I tried those kumquat-flavored ding-dongs. They were made me want to spit out my mouth. They were no good. Well, you're not going to rush back and do that again. So all of this influences our attitudes and beliefs, which influences our behavior next time around. So marketers are well aware of this stuff. They're well aware that how consumers think about the characteristics of their brand or their product, how they're evaluating these things, affect their decisions next time. And so we want to influence these things, these attitudes and beliefs, in order to further consumers buying our product. And we do this through the four P's of the marketing mix, right? Some combination of product, price, place, promotion is going to influence these consumers. So one thing we might do is to change beliefs about a brand's attributes, its characteristics, okay? I'm thinking about, once all the pandemic is over, traveling. And I'm thinking I could either take a trip to jolly old England or a trip to Japan. Both sound interesting to me. But as I mull things over, as you can tell, I barely do English good, right? How in the world am I going to cope in Japan, where they don't seem to speak a lot of English, from what I can tell? Not a lot. So I'd probably be better off in what decision, right? Go into England. Well, then, if you're marketing Japan, you got a problem, because I'm not going to have a positive attitude about your trip. Ah, but you forgot to mention to me that on your trip, if you book with me, we're going to have an English-speaking guide with you. They'll be on the airplane. They'll take you to the hotel. They'll have the excursions ready for you. They'll be with you at the restaurant. Language is no longer a barrier. Oh, I didn't know that. Suddenly, what might my belief about the trip to Japan be? Well, it might be much better. Interesting. You've changed my belief about the attributes, the characteristics that I knew were, that I felt were negative. Of course, you have to understand the consumer know that that was a problem for them before you go changing it, right? Or you might change the consumer's perception about the importance of those attributes. Sure, you might think about going to England, yeah, where they speak English. Or you might think about going to Japan. Now, let me ask you a question, young man. As you go out into the world, where do you think there's going to be more economic growth in the future? In England or in the Asian countries, the Pacific Rim, Japan? I think probably in the Asian countries, Pacific Rim, Japan. Well, then, might it not be interesting to have some experience in Japan, which could go on your resume, might be a talking point and help you in your future career? Yes, that's interesting. So that thing that seemed to be an unimportant, negative, unimportant thing now becomes an important positive thing. Wow. Or, as a marketer, what I might choose to do is add new product attributes, things that you didn't think about. Have you actually been to Japan? You look like you were nodding. Have you been there?
No, but my minor is in Japanese. I'm planning on getting my master's in translation.
Oh, cool. So in Japan, they have these wonderful entertainment centers, geisha houses. They have hot baths. It's actually a social thing. You have sake. Arigato. And so you have this wonderful entertainment experience that you are not going to get in drafty, cold, old England. Wow, hadn't thought. Maybe I should go to Japan. So once we understand what our consumers' attitudes are, what can we begin to do? We can change their beliefs, attitudes, by introducing, by changing their beliefs about the attributes, by changing the belief about the importance of the attributes, by adding new product attributes, and so affect their attitudes and their behavior. Yeah? At one point in time, men did not use body wash. It was not a manly thing to do. Men didn't do it. As you may know, now, how many men use body wash these days? Yeah, almost at least half, maybe more. But it wasn't a manly thing. So Nivea for Men Active 3 can be used both as a shampoo and body wash, but also functions as a shave gel for both above and below the neck. Too much information. Drugstore chain Walgreens featured male grooming in its stores each Saturday in June of whatever year that was, dubbing the event Saturdudes to make sure that men understood the benefits of body wash for men. Axe introduced a shower gel with a very risque campaign, How Dirty Boys Get Clean. Today, it's the most popular men's brand with a 7% share of the total body wash market. What marketers had to do was understand that men at the time didn't get these things and find different ways to change their beliefs and attitudes. Sometimes that's not too hard to do, sort of at a cultural level. Sometimes it's a lot harder to do, depending on how embedded a particular behavior is in the society. For example, not too long ago, I was able to say this was not going to change. However, in recent years, several students have written me and said, I'm a guy, I wear fingernail polish. This one in particular was Alpha Nail, a cosmetics company that claims it's for men and fighters, filling the gap for the male-oriented nail polish market. What? You didn't know the market needed male-oriented nail polish? Well, clearly you were mistaken. because men apparently have very specific nail polish needs that cannot be satisfied by mere normal lady polish. For starters, Alpha Nail is designed by men, worn by warriors. Oh, okay, I can see how nail polish designed by men would differ dramatically from... Oh, no, wait, it's still nail polish. But how many of you men either wear or know some man who wears nail polish? Not quite as many as we have on some of the other topics, but it's become a thing, which a few years ago, people were going, no, it's not a thing. Attitudes change over time. Social norms change over time. Marketers can help influence these. So I said no at one point in time. Now it's maybe for a niche. On the other hand, maybe I'm wrong here too. How about mangere? Ladies, Valentine's Day just came and went. Anybody buy some nice mangere, lingerie for their men? Say again, could have? Okay, well, men's lingerie is a thing. Here's what it looks like. Here's a question you probably asked yourself. Why don't men wear lingerie? Well, it's one of those topics that until now has never really needed addressing. But mangere is an actual lingerie brand for men. It's here to change the discourse on gender-specific intimates. Mangere intends to change the way men think about their underwear and how they look at them, providing a unique collection of lingerie exclusively for men. How many guys think this will be a wave of the future? You're interested? One person? Web students in the privacy of your own home, perhaps? So this is, yeah, this is an actual, real, live, living company. You can jump out and find something appropriate for your... Yes, well, there you go. It's a thing. I'm not too sure if that's going to be the next thing that catches on the way body wash did. Some attitudes are more strongly held than others, harder to change, more culturally difficult to change. What about, oh, I didn't have this one. The other thing I'm seeing, and I've seen this for 30 years and it still hasn't caught on. Who knows grunge bands? Grunge bands? Grunge band men sometimes wear skirts of different kinds. It was a thing at, way back when.
Yeah, it was an older thing.
It was an older thing. And the, question was, the fashion statement, would skirts for men and dresses for men catch on, separate from lingerie?
Yeah.
So far, not. Although you're saying, yeah, how many women, fashion students, are we seeing dresses for men?
Yeah.
Oh, all right, I'm in the wrong industry. Because how many guys are, yeah, with a skirt on top, right. How many guys are up for a nice sundress, nice skirt, an evening gown perhaps? Men? Hello, man. Anybody there? Okay, we got one. We got two. All right, guys, hook up with the fashion students. Oh, maybe you are fashion students. So there you go. You are fashion students. All right, I'm not too sure how that niche is going to work out. Again, write me in 5 years. Let me know. All right, so another psychological influence on consumer decision-making is their lifestyle, how they live their lives. Lifestyles are the individual patterns of living as reflected by people's interests, opinions, spending habits, and activities. How do you measure such abstract things? Well, there's a technique, psychographics. So psychographics is a technique of measuring lifestyles and VALS. VALS stands for values, activities, and something else. I like this when I took this picture a few years ago out here. I asked the guy for permission. I live, I ride, I am Jeep. It's a lifestyle statement. It's who he is. It's how he sees himself. A strong statement of who he is. So the VALS typology, VALS attitudes and lifestyles is what it stands for, has essentially two dimensions to it. From bottom to top, we have the issue of resources available. That's education and health. I guess the strong things that come to, well, money. And the notion is, at the very bottom of this whole thing, you have people that are just barely getting by, just surviving. Not a huge market niche. And these folks are not willing to take risks. They're not innovative. They're barely getting by. They're not going to go try something new and different. At the very top, you have innovators. High resources, innovative, but also a rare, you know, the top percent of the population. So they're also rare. Left to right, then, we have what are the primary motivation of these people in the middle. Some are ideal-driven. those who are deal-driven that have relatively lower resources and lower in innovation are believers versus thinkers. Achievement-oriented people, those that are lower and achievement-oriented, are strivers. What are they striving to do? Be more successful. That's their whole thing. They like to rise up to be an achiever. Over here we have those that are into self-expression. Self-expression with less resources are people that are makers. And those that have a little more resources are experiencers. So how might this, well, first let's take a peek at it as it lives. So here it is, the U.S. framework and VALS types. VALS segments the U.S. adults into 8 distinct types or mindsets using a specific set of psychological traits and key demographics. This is the one we were just talking about. What one should I click on just to show you what it looks like? Someone yell out a type. Louder?
Thinkers.
Thinkers? All right. You got to either be loud or close. All right, so what is a thinker? How can we talk about thinkers generically? Because obviously the actual research costs much more money. So members of the thinker group have an ought and should benchmark for social conduct. This is how we should behave. This is how we ought to behave. Have a tendency towards analysis paralysis. They think too much about everything. They plan, they research, they consider before they act, overly rational. They enjoy a historical perspective. They're financially established. They're not influenced by what's hot, because they have to think about what ought to be and what should be. They use technology, but in functional ways. They prefer traditional intellectual pursuits, and they buy proven products. Point, if this begins to describe your consumer, you might begin to think, what approach could you take to influencing them? What sort of ads might they want to see? What sort of brochures? What sort of websites? What's going to appeal to them as thinkers? Let's take a look at a couple ads that were aimed on this area. Let's take a look at an ad that looks to be focused on a maker category, a maker lifestyle. So if you're a do-it-yourself or a maker, does that have an appeal for you? You do it. We make it happen. But it's all yours, your creativity. Yes. Let's take a look at something that might appeal to an experiencer. Self-expression. Doing it their way. Having excitement.
They say good things come to those who wait. What do they know? Why wait when you can get the Yamaha motorcycle, ATV, or Yamaha Rhino of your choice right now? The Yamaha Why Wait sales event.
That's not waiting, hanging back, waiting for, you know, the thoughtful process. That's why not do it? Why not do it now? Why not experience this excitement? What type of lifestyle does your consumer have? What would appeal to them? Then we have a variety of sociocultural influences on the consumer and their purchase decisions. Personal influences, reference group influences, family influences, social class influences, subculture influences, and culture influences that we have to keep in mind. So here we are on our little model, okay? The right-hand side, we see culture, subculture, social class, reference group, family. All of these are normative influences flowing into lifestyle, personality, attitudes, beliefs, purchase intention. So, talking to other people, your social group, can influence whether or not you ever try a product. How many of you have gone to a restaurant, tried a book, watched a movie, TV show, or listened to music because a friend of yours said, let's do that? Okay? It influences people. Of course, we know that in marketing. Brand evaluation. We talked before, I think, about you making that purchase of that new shirt, that new blouse, that new pair of shoes, that new hairstyle, you think it's really good. Your friends go, eh, what were you thinking? Suddenly you don't feel so good anymore about that brand evaluation. Your purchase decision, your satisfaction, all of these can be influenced by the attitude of other people, personal influence. Opinion leaders are an important thing for marketers to think about. These are people within your social group better for us if it's actually in person, although that's becoming less common, or opinion leaders on the internet, which are, of course, influencers. These people are attuned to the fill-in-the-blank, restaurants, movies, books, science. They know what's going on. They pay attention. And when you have a question, because they're one of your friends, you go ask them, any new restaurants I should go see? And they know they are opinion leaders. If a marketer can identify those opinion leaders and send them magazines and send them to news articles, etc., they can influence other people. Does anybody here happen to be an opinion leader for fashion, restaurants, movies, books, science? People turn to you for that sort of information? Couple? A little bit? Couple. Okay. So you're a bit of an opinion leader. You influence other people, and you're more attuned to what's going on. Here we have Calvin and Hobbes. Nowadays, ads don't just sell a product, they sell an attitude. Look at this one. Here's a cool guy saying nobody tells him what to do. He does whatever he wants, and he buys this product as a reflection of that independence. And the tiger says, so basically this maverick is urging everyone to impress their individuality through conformity in brand name selection. And Calvin says, well, it sounded more defiant the way he said it. But that's the idea of an opinion leader, helping other people to make that decision. Word of mouth, of course, that is part of what goes on in terms of opinion leaders, but also we talk to each other. Whether or not we're an opinion leader, we still chat with one another. So that can get influence product trial, brand evaluation decisions, etc. Pete Comita says $1.82 billion are spent by marketers to get people talking about their brand, about their experience, about their retail stores, etc. So we think it's pretty important. When we take it to the world of social media, then we get the idea of buzz. So you can be a buzz agent. Get buzzworthy products from your favorite brands. Share your opinion and spread the word about your experience. Join now. It's a real live site. You can actually participate and get free stuff and talk about it honestly on the web. Anybody here do that? Get free stuff and talk about it on the web to others? What sort of product category?
Cosmetics.
Okay, so they would send you stuff, you would try it and give your honest opinion on what, a blog or a website or whatever, a feed? Okay, whether or not you liked it. Yay! Not a bad deal. All right, so marketers are well aware of this sort of influence on consumers. Who are the top 10 social influence in social media 2020? You probably know these people better than I do. Cristiano Ronaldo, am I saying that right? Do we know that person? Yeah, everybody knows that individual. How about Justin, what's his name?
Bieber,
thank you. Taylor Swift, Ariana Grande. Okay, so we know, I know some of these folks, Kim Kardashian. And if we jumped over to 2022, we'd find a somewhat different list. Here's the Instagram influencers who will be interesting to follow. I don't know, at Zach King, does anybody know him? Oh yeah, people are nodding yes. Okay, well there you go. Brett Manrock, I'm sorry, I don't know these things. At Adam W. All right, so, no, I won't become an industry expert. So it's out there, marketers are doing it, and people are tracking it. In a networked world, we have some interesting influences. So let's think about the old way of influencing consumers and how things happen. So in the old way, you'd get awareness, because people don't buy products they're not aware of, right? Broadly, through things like TV or radio or out of door. Oh, that's a thing. Then you might get people to consider your brand by doing things like direct mail and brochures. You might begin to build preference by having product tests, free samples, comparison, bits of information. Get them to go to action through making an in-store purchase. And then to get loyalty, you might have a rewards card, you know, buy 10 and get one free, you know, that sort of thing, yeah? So that was sort of the old way of funneling down to getting consumers involved in loyalty. Things have changed a little bit. All of this is still valid. We still have need for a lot of that. We still see a lot of it. But we now have to add in all of these influences from social media. So we also get awareness through being sure our search engine optimization is optimized. When people search for the product, you pop up through buzz, through blogs. We get consideration by online having stuff available for online research. and we have user reviews. We begin to build preference by having a strong social network presence, having stuff on YouTube, having local search available. We get action through group discounts. Who's done a Groupon? Groupon, yeah. I mean, we're getting you to action. Purchase online, in-store, on mobile. We get loyalty, maybe perhaps by friending through Facebook, Twitter, email, or customized upselling occurs. And then we can add a stage in social media that we didn't have before very much. Advocacy. Not only are you brand loyal, you want to promote the brand. That's how strongly you feel about it. So we get reviews and links and likes and social buzz from people that, real people, that actually really like our brand that much. That's pretty cool. Anybody an advocate for any brand? You are such a strong fan, you advocate for it, either in person or online? Yeah? What sort of thing do you advocate for?
I mean, I'm wearing a jacket for a game that I absolutely love right now, Destiny 2.
Okay, what's it called?
Destiny 2.
Destiny 2. All right, so if I chatted with you, you'd be telling me about Destiny 2.
I could talk for hours about it.
No, no, thanks. That's good. But I got your point. So you are a true advocate. You got to consider Destiny 2. All right, so social media influences how consumers get information about our products and brands. A while ago, Philips Sonicare Essence, they sent out a $70 Sonicare Essence toothbrush to 30,000 Buzz agents, along with coupons. So you tried the product. If you really liked it, you could hand out coupons to your friends. Those 30,000, by the way, if you do this, be sure you have a good product. Don't do it with a bad product. So those 30,000 agents each told an average of 9.4 other people about the new product. Those 282,000 people in turn told, word of mouth, an average of 4.14 more people. So they got a total direct person-to-person discussion among 1,449,480 people. They calculated that this represented a boost of $2.5 million. Money well spent and the power of getting people to talk about your product. So getting that buzz going, money well spent. I see pens are still moving. Maybe I'll take a sip here of whatever's in here. Okay. So social media influencers and consumers' purchase decisions, whether it's endorsing a skincare product, a luxurious handbag, a new model SUV, or even the latest knitting accessory, there's a digital influencer for virtually every product. How does this influence work? Well, it builds brand awareness. Social media influencers have a solid understanding of the platforms they're using and how to create impactful and engaging content which can build more awareness for a brand. Strengthening customer relationships. 77% of consumers have had relationships with brands for a decade or more, and 61% of loyal customers would make an extra effort to shop from their favorite brands. So it's important to establish a connection with your target market. Consumers are more likely to trust other people than you. Peer recommendations, as they're generally considered more trustworthy than claims in brand ads and social media influencers, can be a very powerful force with their followers. So pretty important to keep that in mind. Can improve buying decisions with unbiased opinions. Social media influencers are great storytellers. They know how to communicate effectively with their audiences. One of the main reasons why consumers trust influencers is because they can relate to these individuals on a personal level. They know them. They like them. Influencers don't just put up an ad on their feeds. They talk about the products in detail, how to use them, if they're value for the money, what consumers should expect, etc. Basically, influencers covered most asked questions that consumers generally have about any brand or products, and this can massively boost a brand's reputation and drive your sales. So unbiased opinions. How many of you folks make regular use of social media before you make a purchase of any significant product? Less than I thought. I do, and I'm older than you. So let's think more about this social milieu in which consumers can find themselves. You're looking at me, this is retail store. We know that consumers' choice in retail stores are affected by what they see on the shelves or racks. Well, duh. But now comes reports that their choices are also affected by how they are seen themselves by other people in their social environment. In other words, shoppers behave differently in the presence of other people. We all know this from a bit of personal experience. You tend to buy differently when shopping with a friend than you do with, say, rushing through a store alone after work. How many of you guys shop differently with mom and dad than you do with a friend? Everybody. Why? Well, in part, maybe they're funding it, but in part, there's also this social interaction. I may not buy that with mom standing there. But recent studies go deeper than that and include the effects of anonymous other people on consumers' choices. For example, consumers feel more negative emotions, annoyance, self-consciousness, when they're in retail environments where there are lots of people around them. I guess that's pre-pandemic, right? So if you feel crowded, you get annoyed. Consumers change their behavior to choose products that might be considered more normatively appropriate, low-fat cookies rather than double-stuffed Oreos in a busier store where people can see what you're buying. This effect is more pronounced the closer other people are. Consumer alters their behavior, even in the presence of just one other person. Have you ever been in a store and had a salesperson hover around you, stay by you? Did that make you feel good? You really wanted more of that? Go away. Thanks, you've greeted me. You've pointed me to double stuff. Now go away. I don't need you hovering over me. You might be trying to be helpful, but you're just being annoying. Words to sell by. A consumer's choice of product might not be affected by whether they want to actually buy it, but by whether anyone is standing around them when they pick it off the shelf. The point? Hover with care. The right attention can prompt consumer choice. But if your customer feels observed in their social environment, they may just walk out on you. Not what you hoped for as you were hovering. What's the social environment? Another social cultural influence on consumers is the family. The family is pretty important when we think about baby consumers growing up to be consumers. So consumer socialization is the process by which people acquire the skills, the knowledge, the attitudes necessary to function as consumers. And the family is a key factor in consumer socialization of children. So when you were a young kid, did you learn anything about how your parents shopped, just perhaps from watching them? Did they do comparison shopping? Did they buy the same old thing? Did they buy at the high-end store? Did they buy at the low-end store? What brands did they like? And oftentimes this informs the way we shop as well. I joke, but it's actually true. My wife was raised in a well-to-do Washingtonian family. I think I already said they belong to a country club. I'm just out of blue collar where I came from. I'd never been in a country club. Oh, let's go to brunch at the country club on Sunday because it's Sunday. What? That's why today, still, she's shopping at Saks Fifth Avenue, Nordstrom's, and so forth, and why I still prefer Kohl's and occasionally Walgreens. We learned how to be consumers differently. Marketers are aware of this, and they create commercials to target this family influence. What did mom do? What did dad do? How should you shop? Mom is teaching the child to have a brand preference for this particular brand. Family decision making is quite interesting to us. The family can be the consumer. So far, if we thought about consumer behavior, what have we been thinking about as the consumer mostly? You, the individual. You're doing things for your needs, wants, and desires. Not a lot of complexity in there. You don't have too many voices yelling at each other. In the family, though, you have a different situation, right? The family has limited resources and unlimited demands. Mom, dad, one kid, two kids, three kids, and they all want stuff. So oftentimes this sets up a bit of compromise, a bit of conflict in the family. What restaurant do we go to? What do we do on vacation? What kind of car do we get, et cetera, et cetera? What kind of cereal do we get? And a bit of compromise. How does it work for your consumers? I don't know. You have to. A long time ago, there was a great advertisement from Volkswagen, when Volkswagen was still a vibrant young brand. It showed a pan across an American neighborhood. Here had a regular U.S. house with mom, dad, two kids, a dog, and in the driveway was a big, expensive American car. It continued panning, and essentially had almost identical house, mom, dad, two kids, dog, and sitting in their driveway was a washer, a dryer, a sofa, and a Volkswagen. You have limited dollars, lots of people need things, buy a Volkswagen and have money left over for the other things in your life. Aware of this issue of conflict and compromise. The family is not stationary, it changes over time. So we start off as young and single. How many of you would consider yourselves young and single? Not everybody? Okay, well, I won't ask why you're not young or single, but anyhow, young and single. What are we spending our money on? Well, most of us aren't buying houses, aren't buying fancy furniture. We're spending stuff for, well, I don't know what you do in the time of a pandemic, but in principle, in going out, in having fun, maybe in impressing someone from the other, or from the appropriate, what am I trying to say here? Trying to impress significant others in your expenditures, maybe trying to get through college, but that's what you're focused on, is being young and single, right? Now, you're young and married without children. Do your attitudes, needs, wants, and desires change? You bet they do. So suddenly we have to be concerned about our finances, how it's working out with somebody else, what our investments might be, what sort of, are we going to have a place, what sort of place we can live in? Young and married with children, whole new set of expectations. Middle-aged, married with children, kids are perhaps in college, different needs. Middle-aged, married without dependent children, what do we call that stage? What's it called? Children are gone. Empty nesters, okay? They have different interests. They have more money, perhaps, because the children are gone. They're not putting through college. Vacations, adult vacations. Maybe it's time to go buy that Ethan Allen furniture that you've been wanting for a long time. It wasn't appropriate when the kids are in the house. Older married, and then older unmarried. Often women, why are women the older unmarried group, often? What causes that? Men, what? Yeah, men die off earlier, and so oftentimes you can have older adults being women. But then you have all these other paths, right? So you have young married without children, young divorced without children, middle-aged without children. You also, of course, have young single with children. What does this mean for your consumer? What are they thinking about? What's important in their life? What are the needs, wants, and desires? When's that transition occur? As you become a senior and marketers know that, you're going to get a boatload of new advertisements, new brochures, new emails in your life because marketers know you're making a transition. So where is your family and what do they want from you at this, at the appropriate stage of the family life cycle? In the family, usually, one person doesn't make all the decisions. We have different roles in the decision process. Let's imagine mom or dad, the family, wants to get a new computer. How many of your moms and dads would not be totally confident just going and getting a computer on their own? Would not. Okay, so they might want someone in the family to help them with this. Maybe they'd want someone to bring information into the family on this particular topic. Maybe they would choose their college son or daughter who might have more tech stuff. So the college son or daughter goes out, finds information, and begins to bring it back to the family. They're the information gatherer. Might that be important to know who's gathering information for the family if you were selling computers? Yeah. The information gatherer brings the information in. And they can influence the decision-making in interesting ways. How many of you information gatherers really like PCs? You're a PC fan? How many of you really like Apple products? What are you going to bring to the family to consider more of? Apple, PC, yes? So it's interesting to know who the influencer is, what preferences they have, what their media habits are, how to reach them. In our family, we'll pretend that mom runs the budget in this household. So mom isn't gathering the information. She's saying, look, I don't really care. Apple, PC, I don't care what we have. But we're not going to spend more than $1,200. So the influencer here is someone that influences the decision process without being directly involved. Again, we'll have a traditional family here. The decision maker here is dad. So dad's going to take the information from the influencer, the budget, and the information that's brought in by the information gatherer and begin to make the decision on what to buy, right? That might be important for us to know who's the decision maker in the family. The purchaser is an interesting role for us in marketing. Sometimes the purchaser is not of interest to us. They're told where to go, when to go, what to buy, how to pay. They're just an agent. We don't have any influence over them. They don't have any choice in what's going on. On the other hand, sometimes the purchaser has choices. How many of you guys did grocery shopping for your parents when you're still at home? Grocery shopping? Okay, and I assume for some products, they told you what to get. And in others, they just said, well, go get some whatever. So you were able to get some whatever that was whatever you wanted. This leads to the question in the old days when there used to be 17 magazine for women, young ladies, why were there so many food products advertised in 17 magazine? Because although some guys were grocery shoppers, a lot of young ladies were grocery shoppers for the family, and we'd want them to know V8 juice was something you should consider when you go to get beverages, right? So who is the purchasing agent? What decisions do they have? How should we reach them? What is their media preference? The user. In our example, who's the user? Person who bought the computer, is that what you said? Oh, well, but there's no gift here. We're buying a computer. The family. We have enough problems trying to make sure you're happy. Now we have to do what? Make sure the whole family is happy with the vacation, the cereal, the computer that we're buying. So we have to understand what those needs, wants, and desires were and how we can make sure that they're all happy to the best that we can. So marketers have to know who plays these roles for their products, and whether and how to reach them with what information. What is their media exposure habit? Is it the same for mom, dad, and the information gatherer? Probably not. Is the purchaser having any decision-making ability, or they're told what to do? Social class. We all know the concept of being from a lower, middle, or upper social class, yeah? That did set up quite an interesting set of conflicts early in my marriage, as I was more lower and she was more upper. Lots of interesting conversations. How many of you have ever interacted with somebody from a distinctly different social class? Have you felt, how many of you who have interacted with somebody from a distinctly, didn't feel entirely comfortable? Almost everybody put up their hand. You aren't exactly sure, depending which way it goes, are you dressed quite right? Are your manners quite right? Are your words okay? Are you dressed up enough? Are you dressed down enough? There is a difference in class. And this social class is a big influence on a variety of things. Social class influences your personal values. How much and why do you value education? How much and why do you value investment versus spending? How much, et cetera. So it influences your personal values, your attitudes, your activities, your social interactions, and your consumer behavior. Where you shop. Many blue-collar women could afford to shop at Tiffany's and Saks Fifth Avenues. They have the money, but they're just not comfortable in that environment. It's not what they're used to. It's not their fashion sense, their fashion taste. It's not their values. Likewise, some upper-class ladies could shop at Walmart. Some of them might be struggling because they're already spending as much as they need to, even at their upper-class wealth. They're just not comfortable in Walmart. It influences your life. What percentage of people marry people from the same social class would you imagine? Just throw out a number. There's no way you would know. 70, my research says about 80% of the people get married to people from a similar social class. Why? First of all, that's who you meet. But second of all, you have those shared norms and values and behaviors. Makes life easier. Subculture. We talked a little bit about that when we talked about external factors. Subculture, the subgroups within the larger or national culture with unique values, ideas, and attitudes that they share among themselves that's different from some other subcultural group. Now, everybody has, in the U.S., has American cultural values that override everything. The question is, what does your subculture have? So, Hispanic, as a subculture, might have certain food preferences, might want Spanish language on their instructions, on their labeling, etc. African Americans, and we have seen certainly the impact of the Black Lives Matter movement on brands who've changed their images, their positioning, who they are relative to this group. As we know, not all but many African American skin tones are darker. That has implications for cosmetics. Asian American, it goes on and on. Where else are we? Etc., etc., etc. So, what subcultures are there out there, and for your product, do they have any needs, wants, and desires that make them different than everybody else? If so, what should you do about it? And I have 3 minutes left. I think I can just get this amusing piece out. I think we talk about how similar we are to other to Great Britain. I was making a comment about that before. Let's see how similar we really are.
Now, I'm going to give you some slang, some American slang. We're going to take turns. We'll see how much you know and how much I know.
Okay.
Okay? The first one I'm going to give you is flossing. Do you know what flossing means?
You mean actually flossing?
No, it's slang.
Right. It's slang.
You do know what actual flossing is.
Well, I know. I know the American's opinion of British dental practice, but yes, I do know about
right.
It.
Flossing.
That would be something close-fitting, and no. I know. I don't know.
No. Oh, there was...
That would be...
That was to really show you how wrong you were.
There right. That's kind of rubbing it out.
Yeah,
that's
it really
of aggressive,
is.
Isn't it?
It was aggressive. I'm sorry. Because I could have just said no, but we just... In America, we like to really rub it
with
in.
With a klaxon.
Yeah. it's showing off, flossing.
Really?
Yeah, showing off is flossing.
Okay.
Yes.
All right. What sound does it make when you're right? It's a, it's both.
Like yeah. Which is probably a different sound in England.
It is, yeah. Well, we're never right in England. Chinwag. Chinwag. Yeah, I'm going to say it again.
Okay. Chinwag.
Yeah.
That would be a blundering idiot. A shinwag. You shinwag. No?
No. It's actually a verb, and it means to chat. It literally to wag your chin. It's actually very literal. It's not really...
Shinwag.
Chinwag. Did I mispronounce it?
I think that's why. I never would have gotten it wrong.
Oh.
I just couldn't understand the thick British accent.
Can we look
accent?
At that in slow motion?
Yeah.
Okay, I thought I would have your full attention, but I see that your attention is wandering as I get down the last 30 seconds. The point here is... You would think Great Britain, English, American, English, not so much. And by the way, of course, some of the language here is subcultural language as well. So even where we think there's a common overlap, there may not be. You got to understand the consumer, which is what my last slide says, which I'll bring up next time because you want to go. Bye.